Well, good morning, everybody. It's so delightful to be here, and I want to send a thank you to Marianne and Alexa and everybody who's like done such a good job of inviting me here and hosting. Joyce and Andy have been wonderful hosts. Cindy and I arrived last night and have such a beautiful community here. We lived in Grand Rapids for 1 year back in 1992, I think it was, 92, 93, and we haven't been back to Western Michigan since, so it was really nice to come back and see a very different Grand Haven that's really flourishing and has a lot of civic engagement, a lot of social interaction, and it's beautiful to see a community like this. I want to talk to you about Third Places. It's been my passion really for the past year. My book came out last June, and I've been talking to communities ever since then. And it's really wonderful to go into communities and talk about the importance of friendship, about cultivating the kinds of places where we can become more engaged with one another and I think happier. Like we all know that we're in time of turmoil and great change. As a university professor, I've been seeing it in my students for the past 10 years. 10 years ago, I was thinking, like, these are the best students I've ever had. These are the most engaged and hardest working and so forth. And since then, there's just been this decline. Decline of deep kind of social unease. And it's getting worse and worse. And there's a lot of people that are studying this. And it's puzzling because if we look overall at what's been going on in our world, and going on in our world for quite a long time, kind of objectively speaking, there's never been a better time to be born on planet Earth. Like since 1950, we've reduced extreme poverty in the world from a 75% rate to around a 10% rate. I mean, that's amazing. That's amazing. That's happened in people's lifetime. We've remarkably reduced extreme poverty in the world. Life expectancy has been going up consistently every year except for 2021. It's gone up on every continent in the industrial age. And so, like, life expectancy worldwide has never been greater. If we look at historical records, childhood mortality, that is the number of children that die before the age of five, is for all of human history, it's been around 40% until the industrial age that starts improving. So now it's around 5%. I mean, these are remarkable things. And even if we just look, and despite worries about things like climate change, like in this country, over the last 20 years, we have decoupled GNP from carbon emissions, and so we find them trending in opposite directions. This is something that has never happened since like about 1880. We've always coupled economic growth with carbon emissions, and now we're no longer doing that. So like there's all kinds of ways and we're making remarkable progress. And yet, if we ask people, do you think the world is getting better or worse? Overwhelmingly, the answer is worse. But here's what's remarkable about that. The places where people are most cynical about whether the world is getting better or worse are the places where living conditions are the best. So, like one very large survey that was done about 5 years ago asked that question, and we found out like only about 5 to 6% of people in the most developed countries thought the world was getting better. Like in the United States, Australia, Germany, Great Britain, only 5 to 6% of people thought the world was getting better. China, about 40%. Right? So why is that? And it seems to be technology. It seems to be technology and prosperity. And you couple those two things, and what we get is increasing distrust of one another. And we find that we've only been measuring trust in the United States since 1972. We've been doing annual surveys. How much do you trust other people? How much you trust institutions? Every year it's been declining. Okay. In 1972, about 70% of people said they trusted other people in general. Now it's about 20 to 25%, depending on what surveys we look at. That's a huge decline, right? If we don't, so why would we trust each other less? Why would we have less confidence and trust in institutions? Because institutions have been largely successful. I mean, we have much greater literacy worldwide. Like we're doing a good job at addressing all kinds of healthcare needs and poverty needs, and and how do we do that? We do it mainly through our institutions. Crime rates have been going down consistently for the past 50 years. And yet we're more fearful of crime than we've ever been. So if we look at the measurements of objective well-being and compare it to subjective measures of well-being, they're trending in opposite directions. And that's what's so strange, because you would think that, well, if we're actually making progress on all these aids, like if we're living longer and we're healthier and we have less poverty, we're more prosperous, we're making advances in all these things, that must be because our governments and our universities and our corporations are all, they're all pretty effective, they're doing what we want them to do, then we ought to have more trust and more confidence and working harder at investing in them and building them up and making them stronger. And instead, we're in this cycle where we're tearing all of them down. Right? And our young people are watching this and they're looking at this future and they're still like, all of these things that are like markers of stability and predictability in our future, they're all being torn down because people don't trust them. That's a very frightening future to enter into. And so you then there's no surprise, like young people especially, on measures of subjective well-being, that's been declining really rapidly. And now I'll just say this, like, so we can measure when the decline started for young people. When we're looking at people, say, age of from 13 to 25, that decline in measures of subjective well-being started dramatically changing in 2012. This is the first year that the majority of middle school kids had their own smartphones and their own social media accounts. And that's been changing every year. If you look at baby boomers and their measures of things like anxiety and depression, other measures of subjective well-being, it's hardly changed at all. And why is that? Is it because baby boomers don't have smartphones and social media accounts? No, it's because they use it very differently, because they already have their social networks. If they have social networks that are already established and they use technology to enhance and as a tool to manage their social relationships, social networks that are already established, but young people use digital medias to establish their relationships and has a very different effect on the brain and one's what we call the social identity, that who are you in relation to other people? That's very different if it's established mainly online, where your approval and rejection is very volatile. And it's not only kind of unpredictable, it can go up and down day by day or hour by hour. It has no like real firm footing, in the same way like if you have a circle of good friends and you have something either really bad or really good that happens to you and you share it with them, what they do is they kind of bring you back to reality, to kind of an even keel. So you always have, you know what your baseline is. You know where you stand with a group of people that you've gotten to know really well. You don't have that if your social identity is primarily online. And the most recent study of 13-year-old boys is that they spend an average of about 18 hours a day on digital media. So, like, this is... And we find that like up to 2 hours a day doesn't have much effect on depression, anxiety, things like this, but over 2 hours a day starts to have quite an effect. So if you're spending a lot of time, and then if you're sleeping with your phone, then it's combined with sleep deprivation has quite an effect. So we're doing things in our society that are, would you say, is strange. Like if we have data, if we've been paying attention, if we know like what produces happiness, what produces somebody with like a kind of grounded personality, a good sense of who they are in relation to others, like we know what it takes. And we know, like, for one thing, the most important thing is a loving family. We've known this since the days of John Bowlby, the pioneering psychologist who founded attachment theory, and he wrote books on separation and loss. And he said, like, children who grow up in an atmosphere of kind of love and security, like they know who they are, they know how they stand within their family and within their community, they're going to develop more confidence and more freedom to go out on the floor and explore and take risks, and they're going to be more trusting, right? And so we know that, like, what it takes to raise children like in that kind of environment, and then we're creating a very different kind of environment. And like some of the things I learned when I was researching for this book and looking at like at this importance of third places is like, well, we know all this stuff. Like we know, for kids' social emotional development, spending more time in social interaction is really important, especially through these developing years. And yet we're cutting down recess more and more because we want to spend more time on academics. And yet we also have studies, like this famous study in Taiwan that was done like before tests. They would have one group of 13-year-olds cram for the test for an hour and the other take a walk outside in nature for an hour. And the ones that took a walk always did better on the test. And so, but what do we decide to do? Let's spend more time cramming. Like we keep on doing things that we know not to do because we're not paying attention. So it's partly not paying attention, but it's partly just developing, we've developed a culture of hyper-competitiveness and individualism and a commitment to material prosperity at the expense of social relationships, even though we know from study after study after study that the social relationships are what make people happy. So I'd come across this term third places about 25 years ago and from a sociologist friend of mine. I didn't know too much about it. I read about it. It comes from Ray Oldenburg, a sociologist who was teaching in Florida. And he wrote that our home is our first place, second place is work, third place is where we go to make friends. It's the neighborhood tavern or the coffee shop where we hang out. And he wrote about how they were declining. This is 1989. What happened, like during the pandemic, I started noticing references to third places really started increasing because it named something we were losing. And lots of times, like we develop terms for something we've lost, but we don't know quite how to name. I wrote a column about third places. I'd been integrating this idea of third places into a course on building community that I'd been teaching for about 20 years. And I found like it really resonated with people. And so I wrote this column about it. And I got more response to that column than anything I'd written for the past 10 years or so. It was pretty remarkable. People were emailing me about it and hadn't heard about it. I thought, well, this is, for me, I'd been living with the term for quite a while, but realized that it's pretty profound sometimes. You just get a term that like people say, well, that's what I've been missing, but didn't know. In the pre-talk I just shared with the group, that I gave a talk on the book to a community a few months ago, and afterwards an older gentleman came up to me, put his hand on my shoulder, and he whispered in my ear, "Now I know why I've been crying every night." And I've started paying attention to, especially when I give talks like in bookstores or libraries, smaller groups, you know, like a lot of times it's about 20 or 30 people. And I've noticed there's always a couple people that are there by themselves that come, and they come because they know that there's something missing in their lives and they want to know if they can pick up something about how do they become more engaged? How do they improve that social connection in their lives? And if you've read my book, you know that I start out talking about my dad's life living in a small town in northern Minnesota and how he had a third place. He had a place where he gathered and so forth, and then that place closed and he never found another one. And part of the problem is, like, he ended up dying very lonely and depressed. I was living about 9 hours away, and there wasn't a lot I could do about it. And I didn't even know kind of like what to recommend for him, because he wasn't a very social person. Part of my inspiration for writing the book is that, like, my personality is very similar to his. I happen to be married to somebody who's very social and active, and like, she gets me engaged with other people, and so I'm very fortunate in that way. But what if I hadn't been? I think I'd be in the same situation as my dad. And I think like what for people who are introverted and who are largely comfortable being alone but still need social interaction for their well-being, I mean, just being comfortable being alone doesn't mean that you're doing well, right? We're also comfortable not exercising. It doesn't mean we're doing well. So like, there's things that we need that we don't necessarily like. So even introverts need social engagement. And this is one of the messages of the book. We all need the social engagement. And so this is one of the purposes of the book, is to talk about this. I wanted to also look at, I was wondering, like, how long has this decline in subjective feelings of well-being, but how long has that been going on? Because if we look at data, it's very hard to find studies of this. The earliest studies tracking levels of anxiety go back to about 1990. And we notice that anxiety has been increasing slowly ever since in developed nations since 1990. Right, and that's a measure of like social unease. Rates of depression have been going up slightly since about then. Levels of trust, I indicate, trust levels have been going down since about 1972 when we started studying that. But it's hard to get any data going back further. So I started playing around with something called the Google Ngram, and this is part of the Google Books project. You can go on Google, just type in Google Ngram Viewer, and you can type in words or phrases, and you can find the relative frequency with which those words or phrases occur in printed works, like books, newspapers, and so forth. And so I started typing in different word pairs, and I typed in friend and self, going back to 1800 to 2000. In 1800, the word friend occurs in print about twice as often as the word self. By 2000, the word self occurs three times as often as the word friend. And they cross paths around 1910. So this is fascinating, and I think it's not a story of something that's a change in our society that's happened, say, because of social media or because of smartphones. It's a story of technology, and what the technology does is make us more capable of doing things on our own time, on our own schedule, and gives us more power to do more. And that's just shorthand for saying it makes us more independent. And what we find the greatest levels of subjective well-being in countries that are the poorest, where they are more interdependent by necessity. And countries that are very prosperous, technologically advanced, where we have more independence, we have more capacity, like, we keep improving things in our lives, but we feel worse about our lives because we're not as dependent, which means we don't interact with others, each other's most. So on our drive up, Cindy and I, we stopped at some kind of convenience store, gas station convenience store to get something. And they have the self-checkout counters, right? So you can go in and you can get some water and some snacks and things and check out and never talk to another person, right? And how many of you have done this? Like this is becoming really common. And it's hard even to go to a bank and talk to somebody, right? So like more and more things are automatic and we keep improving that. And this is why like Microsoft is really working hard to get AI into the curriculum because like we can have kids doing more and more engagement talking to bots and spending less time talking to one another, less time talking to their teachers. There's real potential there in access to information. It's terrible when you're talking about social relationship, because one of the things you want interdependency. And we have to choose interdependency. And third places are one of these locations that we have in our communities where we interact with one another and we can choose interdependency. Where everywhere else, like we're rapidly creating a world that's becoming more and more independent, facilitating independence. Okay. So here's this strange thing. Like no generation prior to ours has had to choose this. Because up until this age, we've always been faced like how do we overcome different challenges to survival, just to survival and well-being? And interdependency wasn't something that we could opt out of. It was always a necessity. And it's been so much of a necessity in human history that our brains are really optimized for interdependency. Like we know this, like from all these neurological studies, like our brains are really optimized for collaboration. And we tend to get fear responses when it's outside threats, when we find ourselves isolated from the group or we don't know where we stand. Well, this was for all of our ancestors. That was at the time where we're most vulnerable, when we're outside of our tribe and we might be facing outside threats. And yet, so imagine now like the condition we find ourselves all the time, like if we're at home and we're on social media and we're scrolling through things, we're doom scrolling or what, like we're always, we're in a position where we're literally outside of a group and we're facing threats. And so this psychological condition that's like developed evolutionarily, we're putting ourselves in that situation over and over and over. And this is where you'll find real differences among people. So I will oftentimes just ask a question of group like this. Like say, how many people are pretty happy with their life right now? And I'll get a number of people say, yeah, I'm pretty happy. And I'll say, well, like, what is your life like? And they'll tell me about their involvement in groups and so forth. And right, they're not experiencing the world as being somebody who's alone, facing all kinds of potential threats. Their self-identity is identities. I'm a member of this group or these series of groups, and I move from one group to another, and that's where I belong. I have a large sense of rich sense of identity, and so forth. And then other people are mostly like alone, looking at their computers or watching TV, things like this. You're alone and you're faced with all these threats. And the world is frightening and scary, and that's how our brains are developed. And so what do? We choose then to become more engaged. And there's two ways of doing that. Individually, we do it, but we can also do it communally by saying, okay, as a community, we need to commit ourselves to building and maintaining and sustaining the sorts of places where people can gather. And there's two benefits of this. There's the individual benefit, I mean, there's profound individual benefits from social engagement. So Robert Putnam, who's authored Bowling Alone, like really a transformational study of social engagement, he found that the people who don't belong to anything, if they join one group, their chance of dying in next year is reduced by 50%. That's just profound. Well, what we know is that like becoming a member of a group, having a social network, has real physiological effects. It has effects neurologically and in your cardiovascular system. In fact, and this is like if some of you have read the loneliness report from Vivek Murthy, the former Surgeon General, like what they find is like being alone is like the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Like this has these physiological effects. But the other effect like of being part of a network is like at different times when we find ourselves in crisis, we have somebody to turn to and help out. I have a good friend who's a member of the Y, and she's a member of a women's group that does water aerobics. I don't know how much cardiovascular exercise they get done in this group, but they like afterwards they gather for coffee and brownies and things like that. And the social gathering afterwards at the Y is really important. And last winter, right after a snowstorm, this friend of mine, Priscilla, she gets a call from somebody she knew through that group saying, I didn't know who else to call. The person who normally shovels out my walk didn't get here to shovel me out, and I'm out of my heart medication. I can't get to the pharmacy. Could you pick it up for me? And so she did. She went and picked it up, and then she found a friend to come and help her shovel out this woman's walk, and then she visited with her. But this is like that group, that water aerobics group at the Y was the only group she belonged to. And because she belonged to that group, she knew one person that she could call, right? That's what the profound effect of joining one group. We also know, like, study on dementia, which is increasing rapidly, like in our society. Nobody knows quite why. Yet one of the clues to this is a meta-analysis that was reported in the journal Nature Aging 2 years ago. Found that looking at like data worldwide from Alzheimer's rates and comparing it to social networks. Found that like those who have a robust social network have 30 to 50% reduced chance of Alzheimer's. So like there's all these profound individual effects. And then if we look at communities, we find profound community effects. If you want to look at like what schools have the best outcomes, testing outcomes, and we argue politically about this all the time. Like, what should we do? Is it class sizes? Is it the kind of test? All the things we argue about politically. It turns out the only thing that really predicts improved educational outcomes year after year is high social engagement among the people. If you have people that pay attention to what the school board is doing, if it's easy for the teachers to get volunteers and they go on field trips, all these things. If you have high levels of social engagement, your schools tend to be really good. We also know that murder rates are much lower. In fact, every kind of crime rate, especially violent crime, much less in places with high levels of social engagement. Children's well-being. Like much better if you have high social engagement. And so there's all these individual benefits and then there's community benefits. So somebody, I'm just about running out of time here, right? So here's five things. These are the five things I'm recommending now. I wish I'd put it this succinctly in my book. I didn't do it. But this is one of the things, like, you write the book, and then you go out and you talk to people, and you learn things. And it's like, oh, now I know the book I should have written. Number one, emphasize real experiences. We have a world that's, like, full of simulated experience. And we know, especially for young people, for brain development, real experience is very important. So that means in engagement with real people, engagement out in nature, any kind of emphasize real experience. Secondly, with real people, like not with bots and not with people who are like modified in some ways by the algorithm, so you get misrepresentations of what people say, what people believe, what people's experiences are actually like. So real experiences with real people. This sounds so basic, right? But we've never had to choose it deliberately before. Like when I was growing up, if somebody had said, you need real experiences with real people, what did that mean? That would have meant like, don't go after school and watch Gilligan's Island. Like, okay, yeah. Like, that probably wasn't a very good thing on my development to watch Gilligan's Island and Hogan's Heroes so that I knew, like, every rerun, you know, like, 10 times. But it wasn't that bad on me, right? But now, like, we know what that means. It's very basic, and yet, like, it's so basic it seems like we wouldn't have to mention it, but we do. The third thing is prioritize friendship. And don't think that friendship is something that develops by accident. We know how important it is. It's vitally important for our well-being. It's the number one determinant of happiness. And yet it's something we don't really teach it intentionally. And we don't design our lives to maximize happiness. And we could do that. We haven't done it. Here's one of the things we know that's just fascinating. The circle of acquaintances, that is the people that you recognize, you might know their name, but you don't know a lot about them, but you know enough to say hi to them if you meet them in the grocery store or something. That circle of acquaintances, the circle of acquaintances you have when you're about 20 years old corresponds really highly to the number of good friends you have when you are 50. So if you have a large circle of acquaintances at a young age, you're going to tend to have a pretty robust circle of good friends when you're 50. What we know is that that circle of good friends at 50 years old has been declining for each generation. 1990, it was about 30% of people that said they had good friends. Now it's 13%. It's declined a lot. But that doesn't mean that, like, if we didn't cultivate a lot of acquaintances when we're 20, like, we're doomed to having no friends when we're 50 or 60. What that indicated is, like, somebody had that large circle of acquaintances, they probably learned the skills of social negotiation and interaction and so forth and got comfortable with it at a young age, so then it became easier to form friends as they got older. It just means that, so what do you do? Well, then you intentionally work at it. You say, okay, where do I go to the places and practice social interaction so that I, because you have to meet a lot of people in order to have a few close friends. Because there's a lot of people you meet and like they're okay, but you're never going to become really good friends with them, right? Right? Yeah, even some of the people I have coffee with every Wednesday, I'm never going to become really good friends with them. I've never told Ben that, but it's just the fact that, like, sorry, Ben, I don't care how many texts you send me. I'm like, number four, become a nation of joiners. I hear this all the time. I'm just not a joiner. That's not a personality trait. I'm sorry. You aren't born with, like, joiner, not joiner, imprinted on your genes. Like, it's just a decision you make. And you might have developed a habit over time of not joining groups or something, but like join a group. And there's a really important reason for that. Our well-being depends greatly upon being useful to people. And you can't be useful in the world if you're not useful to someone. And so you have, and so how do you become useful to someone? You make yourself accountable to them. Right? And you only do that by joining, by showing up. And so you join groups and you say, like, yeah, I'll show up. I'm going to show up and help volunteer, do this. I'm going to show up to greet people or to make coffee here. And like, I'm going to do that. And, you know, like, and then people are counting on you, and then you're useful, and people who are useful are much happier, and they develop better social connections. So just become a joiner, sign up for things. And then finally, fill our community with third places. This is really important. This is partly zoning rules. This is partly changing, like, allow like little businesses, little corner cafes and things to take place in, to be developed in neighborhoods. Make sure when there's new developments that those new developments include social gathering places. And then the other way you fill your community with third places is you make a commitment to going to them and supporting them, because many of these places are struggling to go. So those are the five things: real experiences with real people, prioritize friendship, become a nation of joiners, and fill our communities with third places. And those are all choices we can make. So can I finish with one story? Do I have time to? I'm sorry, I'm speaking a little bit long. One of my favorite books, I discovered this book 25 years ago when I moved to La Crosse. It was a book written by a local author there called The Land Remembers by Ben Logan. He'd grown up in a farm in southwestern Wisconsin during the Depression. And it's a memoir. And he writes, one of the stories near the end of the book is called Short Days in Yellow Lamplight. And he talks about the day his dad came home with a new kerosene lamp made by Aladdin. If any of you have heard of Aladdin lamps, it was a brand of lamp, and it had a really bright white light. And their old kerosene lamp was made by Rayo, and the light was dim and yellow. And so after dinner, the kids would gather around in the winter time, it was dark, and they would be doing their homework, they'd spread their books out, they had to gather around the dining room table, and they all sat together as a family for the evening around this lamp. But this new Aladdin lamp had a bright white light, and it lit up the whole room. And so the first night that this lamp was set out, the mother looks around the room, and the kids are all spread out different places in the room. And she says to the dad, "I don't think I like this new lamp." And he says, "What's wrong? It's a lot brighter." And she says, "Yeah, it's brighter, but look what it's done to us." And Ben says, Ben was the youngest child. He says, "My father looked around at each one of us, and we kind of put our heads down, got up our books, and we came back to the table." And the father says, "Should I bring back the old lamp?" And she says, "I don't think it's the lamp, I think it's us. Does a new lamp have to change where we sit at night?" And this is the world we live in. We're not going to get rid of technology. We're not going to go backwards. We're not going to get rid of the things that allow us to become more independent. But we can choose interdependency. We can choose to sit together. And that's the challenge of this generation right now. Like, there's a turning point in our society. And we need to choose this. We can choose where we sit. And that's the lesson of the third place. So thank you very much.